This is the Kestrel Country Podcast, where we discuss the people, places, and events all around Kestrel Country. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Kestrel Country Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Church, joined here once again by my lovely wife and co-host, Catherine.
Hello, hello.
And we are in a lot of rain right now. We had beautiful snow, cold weather. I know we had cold weather all over the country, but it's raining now.
That's okay. I actually like the roads better this way.
Oh, no.
I do. It's easier to drive.
Well, for all of you recent folks who have moved to Kestrel Country, especially from somewhere warmer, don't get too excited because it's still January.
We get plenty
of... We will have more snow.
Well, we get plenty of fake outs.
Oh, yeah.
So... I mean, it starts to look like, oh, we're getting spring. This is spring. And we might even have a great week of amazing weather and park style weather. But then it easily goes back. So we get a few different fake outs typically.
It's true. It's true. Well, this week we've got Brandon Allen on the podcast again. Brandon is a frequent guest. And it was a fun episode. Hopefully you enjoy it. I enjoyed the conversation. We talk about everything from podcasting to mortgages to some business and a little bit of Bitcoin type stuff. I mean, it was all over the place, but good fun conversation with Brandon Allen from Fulcrum Loans. So let's jump right in.
Sounds good.
Well, it definitely is a learning experience, and we have certainly not arrived yet. But yeah, those first few were painful and like very, very difficult.
Were they cringy or was it?
Yeah, there's some cringy ones for sure. And yeah, just hard, like really hard to think through questions and, you know, would feel like, okay, now what do I talk about next with this person? Or I always had, and I still do this, I still have this reaction, especially with people I don't really know when I have them on the podcast, is to try to avoid talking to them ahead of time. Cause I'm like, ooh. I don't want to like waste conversation topics. Silly as that sounds, I'll be like, oh yeah, what have you been up to? I'm like, never mind. Just let's wait until it's rolling because yeah, otherwise I'll run out of stuff to talk about.
What do you feel like are the two biggest lessons or epiphanies or whatever you, however you want to say it, that you've learned from podcasting?
Ooh, that's good. So you're already good at this. You're good at asking questions. I think one of the biggest lessons, which would also be one of the biggest values, and I would say that I just stole it directly from Darren Doan, is just that everyone's interesting. Mm. And so, it was one of the things I think that was daunting at first about the podcast was coming up with people to interview or topics or that kind of thing. And I think it was Darren that encouraged him, like, you can literally have anyone on. And like, if you really believe that everyone is interesting, everybody has an interesting story, everybody, whatever somebody does is interesting, then it's going to be interesting as a podcast. Like you can. And so I think just finding one, that everyone's interesting, two, how many super interesting people there are in our little town, you know? And that's been a fun thing about doing the podcast the way, and I don't know if it was probably Catherine's idea, but the topic, so to speak, of the podcast just essentially being local. People, places, and events is our kind of our theme. And so it's like, it opens up us to really talk to anybody about anything. You know, we've had everybody from Amazon people to, you know, people who started ministry or, you know, nonprofit for wounded veterans to go hunting to, you know, people who started their own business, just all kinds of stuff, right? Yeah. Mortgage to real estate, to home improvement, to, you know, entertaining home decor, whatever. But it's just, as long as it's kind of, hey, let's find who's around us that we can talk to and find interesting. That's probably the first one. Mm. I'm struggling to come up with a second one. I don't know.
Well, you kind of hit two. It's like everybody's interesting and
There's a lot of them around.
There's a lot of, And it's interesting. It's interesting that you say that because in a small town, we could naturally assume that we know everybody and that we know what they're about and what their story is.
True.
And, right?
Yeah.
Because we interact all the time.
Yeah, that's probably the other side of it would just be, one, like you said, how hard it is and probably how rare it is to actually sit down across from somebody and just ask them questions and have conversation, mm-hmm. right? Like that just doesn't happen that much anymore.
That's true.
So that's probably been the part that I've enjoyed about it the most is just, you know, people who it's like, oh yeah, I'd love to, whatever, Nick Stute, like I'd love to sit down and talk to that guy about mm-hmm. hunting, you know, and growing up in Wisconsin and how our stories are similar or whatever. It's like, I know I have kind of the excuse and the opportunity to do it, you know, versus if you're just hanging out with people in a broader setting or whatever, or mixing and mingling, like you don't have that opportunity to really sit down and dig in with someone.
Oh, it's a good point.
Yeah.
Especially as guys too. I don't know, a couple weekends ago, a buddy of mine that I've known since high school, we lived in Chalice together and now he moved back to Moscow a couple years ago. Oh. We got out in the hills for the first time in a couple years. And it's funny because I think as guys, we naturally, you know, we'll have conversation, but it's also really nice just not to, you know, you're driving the car with a buddy. You don't necessarily always have to be talking.
Yeah, for sure.
It's one of the nicest
parts. That's what the podcast forces. Have you seen that? Do you know Nate Bargatze?
No.
Stand-up comedian. Mm-mm. He is hilarious. He's coming to Spokane, by the way, speaking of local events. He's got a couple Netflix specials and stuff. Just super funny, like clean family humor kind of thing. Guy from Tennessee. Anyway, he has – oh, no, it's not. I totally lied. I totally messed up. He is awesome. You should check him out. But this is actually a Brian Regan, an old Brian Regan. And he talks about going golfing with his buddy, and he comes home, you know, and his wife is like, so, you know, how's Gary doing? He's like, I don't know. Fine, I guess. It's like, well, is he seeing anyone since the divorce? I don't know. How would I know that? Like, weren't you in the same cart together for hours? Yeah, it was not like we were talking to each other. Like, we're like playing golf. How is that even going to come up? Yeah. You know, you should use your 3-wood. By the way, have you been seeing anyone?
Yeah. It's like
just the way guys are. Anyway,
I like it. I like it. Man, so how's the year started off for you?
It's been good. Yeah, it's been. I don't know. The last couple of years have been weird, as you know, mm-hmm. In the real estate world. Although I say that, and I really feel like what happened is the last 2 years have been normal. And it was the few years before that were super weird. Mm-hmm. Yep. What I mean by that is just trend-wise. Like, you know, I remember first getting into real estate 10 years ago, and like December, January were super slow. Like it was just kind of a typical cycle of things, right? And then we entered into kind of even pre-COVID, just as the housing market heated up, as things were going, it like became this just like constant year-round frenzy and then peaked, you know, post-COVID. But then last year and this year, it was like November through this, you know, like November, December especially, were just super quiet. Mm-hmm. And it was accentuated by rates. You know, well, obviously you're here to talk about mortgages. It was accentuated by rates peaking. Both of those years, they kind of peaked in November, right?
Yep.
But it was also somewhat of a more typical cycle. So, but yeah, things shut off pretty well in November, December, really slow. Not super disappointed in that, to be honest. Like it's kind of nice to have down seasons, you know, especially around Christmas, just time when it's like days in a row where I can be home with the family and that kind of thing. So. It was good. But I'd say right after Christmas, even between Christmas and New Year's, you know, phones started ringing, people coming, people interested in getting together, talking about selling, talking about buying. So it was a real almost like stark pickup. And it's been the same. You know, I feel like the brakes got hit a little bit with the last couple of days, all this weather we've had. That's natural. It's like when there's ice storms and snow and stuff, people just kind of like hunker down for a little bit. But no, I think it's gearing up to have a lot of activity. That's what it looks like. How about you guys? Similar?
Yeah. I mean, November, December is always the time of year where we have to start talking about being really focused, of dialed, right? Being focused on the turn times that we're giving to each other internally and not, well, I call it controlling the banks, right? It's like the river needs to flow at a certain pace all the time, no matter what the demand is.
Those banks. Like controlling banks. We might be talking about that today too, but somebody else is doing that. The Fed.
Not well either, but yeah, so it was slow. But we're up which is an interesting trend. Like this time, month to date, last year,
okay,
we're ahead of that already. And so for that, I'm super grateful. I do think we're going to have a very strong season, buying, selling season in Moscow and Pullman, kind of the greater area there.
Now, what are rates? I think you said the other day, rates essentially are the same that they were mid-January last year.
Yeah.
Is it's that
almost,
right?
Almost flat.
Okay.
Year over year. We were, you know, we got down into the fives in late January of 23. Mm. It really looked like rates were coming down, but I'd say 6.25, and which we're hovering right in there right now. So right before February, and February was this massive, you know, kind of tidal wave of rates continuously moving up, up and up. We go through a couple different variations, throughout the year, but yeah, big spike in October. And that was the same exact thing. We hit 7% in 22 for the first time, mm-hmm. late October going into November.
Yep.
We hit 8%, you know, this last year. So interesting time of the year for that to happen. And I'm curious what that actually says, right?
Why they did it then, assuming that somebody's doing it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Why did the market behave that way going into January? Into February of 22. And then why for the last 2 years in late October, early November, do rates spike? The Fed can't change mortgage rates like that.
No.
Right? But the market moves.
And the market moves based largely on what the Fed is saying they're going to do.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So let's talk about 23, October of 23. What was going on then? Was that when the Fed was kind of giving signals that, hey, this isn't over, we're going to keep raising rates? Or what do you think led into it? It's hard to remember back to 2022. But 2023, like, what do you think was leading into those rates spiking?
It's a good question. I actually am pulling up just headlines of October 2023.
There was some, I mean, housing has been some of what the Fed has been frustrated with, right? Mm-hmm. Not seeing what they want there,
yeah.
Which I don't think they're going to be able to do anything with unless they really crank rates up. Like, because affordability has been record low for the last year, and yet obviously volume's down a little bit. We're talking about that,
yeah.
But home prices have actually appreciated a little bit amidst high rates and amidst, you know, affordability being in the toilet. And I think I was actually listening to, make sure to give a credit where credit's due. I was listening to David Bonson's Capital Record podcast yesterday. I haven't quite finished it, but it's a good one. He had a guy on, I'm going to forget his name. My phone's over there, but talking about housing data. And what he was basically saying is jobs is what is driving and does drive housing demand is jobs. Because he basically said, yes, affordability. You know, Bonson was kind of asking, like, hey, affordability is at all-time lows. Mm-hmm. Why is home price appreciation being so sticky? He was like, well, because there is still a large, especially in comparison to the number of available homes, mm-hmm. when inventory is low, we still have a really large pool of qualified buyers. Yeah,
that is true.
Right? So there's still a lot of people who have good jobs, who have good credit, who can borrow, right? And so especially when inventory is low, even though this affordability is really high, it's like there's still a lot of people who have good jobs and who can afford to buy. So he was kind of saying, as long as unemployment stays low, as long as those job numbers stay fairly strong, we're not going to see that erode at all. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it actually is going to kind of tee up this headline that I saw on Yahoo Finance this morning that says consumers haven't felt this good about the economy since 2021. I don't know about you, but I don't feel like that's...
Yeah, consumers are idiots.
I don't think that's a true sentiment, personally. But last year, going into quarter four, the Fed was really remaining hawkish on either holding longer for higher or maybe even potential further hikes, right? They hadn't declared victory against the fight, you know, of inflation. And really what they're trying to do is break the labor market. They're trying to increase unemployment.
Yeah.
Which then will decrease the demand in housing and so on. But what they're not accounting for is in these weekly jobless claims that the market kind of hinges on every Thursday, is that a lot of these jobs being taken are second jobs for people. They're working a full-time job and then taking on another part-time job. Or, for example, a retired, somebody living on a pension, Social Security, VA retirement, whatever it is, they're going out and getting another job. And now they're having multiple streams of income just to survive the cost of living. So to say consumers haven't felt this good, you know, I think Yahoo Finance obviously does have some political bias behind it, but I just don't, I don't think that's accurate. I bet if we asked 100 people today, how do you feel about the economy? Like, nobody's going to say, oh, it's great.
Do you know what they're, what that data is that they're pulling from? Is that survey type data, or are they, you know, looking at consumer spending habits and that kind of thing?
This is actually University of Michigan consumer sentiment report.
Oh, it's got to be great.
Got to be.
Michigan versus everybody.
A 13% jump in overall sentiment during the month of January.
Interesting.
Which is super interesting. But if that's a hopeful outlook.
Do you think some of that could be from the fact that they are, people are seeing headlines like, hey, interest rates are going to be going down. We've conquered inflation. We're the even if they're not feeling it day to day in their pocketbooks, right? The headlines are such that, I mean, that, to be honest, that's what I would probably say. Like, hey, is the economy strong? I'd probably say, yeah. I mean, it's, I would be, I would kind of say it in a surprised way, right? Yeah. But kind of like, yeah, I mean, unemployment's still low. Things are, you know, it's like, despite what it kind of feels like personally, things seem to be going well. Right. Like if that's, that's the narrative that's being pumped out, like when you look at the headlines, it's like, you know, jobless claims are down and unemployment's low and, you know, things are strong. Like that's kind of the sense that comes out of the media. And so maybe even if you're feeling the pinch personally in your personal finances, you would say, yeah, I think the economy is pretty strong.
It's interesting because it doesn't.
The stock market, right? Stock market rallied at the end of the year. So if you're, if that's part of your indication, or if you're, you know, somebody who's got keeping an eye on their stock portfolio or whatever.
Consumer savings rates are still pretty low, which is a good indicator of, you know, where it's growing. October, September is 3.8, October 4, November 4.1. We haven't seen the updated information yet for December. But I'd say that's still a super low rate. But if we look back historically, it's pretty average since 2013.
Could some of that, though, correlate to consumer sentiment? It seems like if I'm worried about the economy, I'm starting to save money, right? Like my savings rate's going to go up. So I'm like, I better save for a rainy day. I'm worried about where this is going versus if things are going well, moving along, it's like I might spend that money.
Yeah, if we look back, I'm on fred.stlouis.org, which is the St. Louis Federal Reserve website for that district. Every recession has either in the midst of the recession or somewhere towards the end of it, consumer savings rate increases. And of course, they backdate these gray lines to show when the recession is. So we don't necessarily know
right
away. Kind of battening down the hatches, so to speak. So that could be that. I don't know. It's just interesting. The vibe is not, we're having more clients call us and say, we need to restructure some of our debt, right? The payments are too high. Let's look at using the equity in our home, whether it's a HELOC, a second mortgage, a cash out refi, whatever it is. And to me, that's a really strong indicator of a weak consumer.
Yeah. Are those...
No offense, that wasn't saying weak, as in you're weak if you make that phone call. I'm saying, you know, obviously that it's not strong.
Right. Yeah, for sure. No, but do you think that, are the people who are calling, who are their names? I'm just kidding. That's not. No, what I was going to say is, are the people who are calling, are these, because that's surprising to me if these are people who bought, say, 2+ years ago, right?
With super low rates.
Right.
Yeah.
Are you, because are, it would definitely be more concerning if it was like, yeah, there's a lot of people with 3%, 3.5% mortgages, 4% mortgages who are like, I can't make that payment anymore. Versus somebody who bought in the last couple of years when rates were relatively high, who are like, we were stretching at the time. Or did we see a lot of people really stretch during the time when rates were low who, you know, yeah, rates are low, but they still just took on too much of a monthly payment?
From excuse me, where they were at then, there were definitely – there was a frenzy.
Yep.
Right? And there was a ton of FOMO. And the most consistent statement that I heard from clients buying in 2020 and 2021 is, I want to buy real estate to beat inflation. Like, I need to get rid of my money because I'm worried about inflation.
Yeah.
And so they put themselves in a position where they expended a ton of their capital. And then taxes go up. And then we see core inflation increase. And then we see gas prices increase. And now all of a sudden, they don't have the reserves that they did. And they're sometimes in the red.
So would those people generally be the types who are buying second properties? Not necessarily.
Yeah.
First time home buyers. Yeah.
Investors.
Yeah, interesting.
A ton of people bought Airbnbs.
Yeah. Like, I saw some, I don't know if it was Bigger Pockets or somebody talking about the national data on that. And it's kind of crazy.
It's getting a little wild, a little Western.
Yeah.
But I would say that was the thing I tried to counsel against the most, especially with first time homebuyers or first time investors, was, yes, inflation is going to erode the dollars that are in your bank account. Like, what are you going to make your payments with, right? What if something does go wrong? What are you going to make your payments with? How are you going to stay solvent? So it's interesting.
I mean, it's certainly better than buying one of those, you know, monkey cartoon ETF things.
Oh my gosh.
Like, that was the other thing people were buying to beat inflation. Right. But no, it's true. I think that's absolutely something that we've counseled against a lot too. And you mentioned Airbnbs, like specifically Airbnbs is, you know, I will tell somebody they can be a great way to have good cash flow and make good money on a property, but you should be sure that that property cash flows as a long-term rental. Because as we saw, whether it was COVID and all of a sudden stuff gets shut down, or it's like, what if both Wazoo and U of I have horrible seasons and rates go, you know, or just competition. Like you said, so many new Airbnbs or regulatory, like Moscow all of a sudden says, hey, R1, R2 zoning, we're not going to allow short-term rentals in them or whatever, you know, something like that is, so you want to have that, make sure that there's a ton of cushion in there, whether that's cash reserves or whatever. And I agree. I mean, I certainly don't wish this on anyone. And I think Moscow is stable enough, is growing enough, and particularly in the rental market, that people will be fine. But it's like, I looked at properties selling, I'm like, that doesn't cash flow, right? Like,
right. Yeah, not even close.
And during the frenzy, like you said, it was like multifamily type units, duplexes, fourplexes, where you're like, that's a negative cash flow with the, you know, I'm making some assumptions about the debt, right? If it wasn't a cash purchase and I see that it was conventional, I'm like, okay, I figure some debt to income, you know, or some loan to value, that kind of thing, and figure what it is. And it was like, dude, it's all well and good right now, but if things get tough, you know, and you got negative cash flow, it could be real tough. But as long as rental rates keep going up, as long as, you know, it's like, then you can get bailed out, you know, and appreciation. There's a lot of, we've continued to have price appreciation. I think that's one of the things that, you know, the national headlines keep pointing to is what's so different about now versus like 2008 is the amount of equity in people in real estate in this country is amazing. And so it's like, we're unlikely to see a similar like foreclosure crunch and that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
People just have a ton of equity in their homes and in their properties.
How do you read, what's your read on the commercial crisis that we have going on right now?
Oh, that's a good question.
Is that a leading or a lagging indicator of the economy in your eyes?
Yeah, it's probably lagging, I would think. You know, we're starting to see, you know, it's one of those things that kind of like we were just talking about the property. It's like it's not going to catch up until later, right? So it's not until they have to restructure those loans. It's not until like there's some time before things get bad. And that's what we're seeing right now is like whatever there's, I can't remember the numbers, some insane amount, right, in this next year of commercial loans that are going to either renew or come due. And then it's like astronomically more the following couple of years, right? Typically they're 5-year terms, right? So yeah, there's going to be a ton of loans restructured. There's going to be, and then, so that's where I think it's a lagging indicator is if somebody's having some trouble with vacancy or they're having trouble, you know, with getting enough tenants in or whatever, raising rents enough to keep up, you're not going to really see that until that loan comes to restructure. And then it'll probably be a question of whether either the banks can work with the, will work with these people and can, or if there'll be some sort of bailout to try to allow people to restructure, you know. I mean, most of those commercial loans, there are covenants in them that restrict. It's not like they can just jump by 10% or whatever, right? Like there are caps. There, you know, there's reasonable regulations on it or restrictions on it. But the reality is if there's vacancy, that's where it's going to come into play. I think for people who have their, you know, places fully leased and that kind of thing, they'll probably be fine. One, banks will probably work with them, you know, two, I think it may be being overblown a little bit in the headlines, but hard to say. I haven't spent a ton of time digging into it.
Yeah. I was just thinking about, well, I saw this headline, yesterday, actually. San Francisco's dying Westfield Mall loses $1 billion in value in 7 years, and it's now just worth, you know, just under $300 million. Malls are something that have changed a lot. Like consumer buying behavior has changed a lot.
Yeah,
but I'm also curious how the vacancies. What can we read out of that? Consumers not wanting to go to brick and mortar, or they've already spent their money, and therefore they have no more to go buy and. You know, they're obviously not saving as much and don't have expendable income, consumer expendable income. You know, what does that say?
Yeah, I would probably say, I probably would have been a little bit more optimistic about it before yesterday and today. When did you see Macy's announced huge layoffs?
Really?
And then Wayfair this morning I saw in the Wall Street Journal. You've got your computer. You can cheat here. I left mine upstairs. But I think it was Wayfair said something like 13% of their labor force they were going to lay off, something like that.
That's a big chunk.
So that was online, right? Furniture, decor, that kind of thing. So, you know, some of these retailers are suffering, that's for sure. But I don't know if, it's hard to say without looking at more into the data whether it's just that malls are getting hard hit. It's not just malls. I mean, office buildings.
Yep. When's the last time you went to a Macy's, though? Okay,
but there hasn't been one in Moscow for
A
long time.
I went into the Boise one, right around Christmas time. There were three people in the entire store. It felt like working there, and it was in shambles. Hmm. And I have a very distinct memory of my first banking job, driving from Chalice down to Boise to go and buy some work clothes on a Friday. Monday morning, I'm starting, and it was, you know, prim, proper. The guy's walking me around. He's helping me get all my stuff. Very, very helpful, very professional. You go in now, and it's like, is this Ross? Hmm. So it's going to be very interesting to see what these big box stores do, and where are consumers spending their money if they are?
Yeah.
Are they just online ordering?
It seems like that's, you know, Amazon and those types have to have taken a huge chunk of market share, right? Mm-hmm. I mean— like, you know, I pretty much every day wear the same thing, but like these poncho shirts, like it's an Instagram shirt or whatever. Yeah. It's like, I saw it on Instagram and they're great shirts. And Catherine for Christmas bought me like dress shirts from some similar things, like some online direct to consumer kind of thing, you know? So I do think some of that's changing. And then from a real estate perspective, what's going to be done with that real estate?
You know? Right.
It's one thing to see some of these office buildings are talking about turning into residential. They're doing some of that. You know, what do you do with one of the things that might be, this is getting a little far afield, but It's like, will some of these big box stores become small distribution centers for online, you know, talking to a guy who is involved in like the e-commerce, even like drone delivery type stuff. And it's like, yeah, Home Depot, for example, is, you know, apparently talking about that, like the fact that, or Walmart, like Amazon is known as the logistics company and they're incredibly good at it, right? But you think about who has a presence, who has a warehouse essentially in every town in America. It's like, it's Walmart. And they're already doing this kind of thing, right? Like we, I don't know if you guys do it. Catherine's been big into the whole Walmart delivery thing. So like we haven't, we don't like really even go grocery shopping anymore. Catherine does all her grocery shopping online then on Sunday night. And then Monday, all the groceries end up at our front door, right?
That's
and,
awesome.
And they do it through DoorDash. It's, you know, so it's not like some fancy drone thing or whatever, but just that idea of, consumers want this e-commerce type thing, but where do we have the infrastructure to actually create this like localized delivery? You know, it's like in Seattle, my sister and brother-in-law, it's like they have the Amazon Fresh, right? It's like you can order something in an hour from Amazon, it like shows up at your door. Like it's because Amazon's everywhere. Yeah. But Walmart is who can do that almost everywhere in America.
That's true.
So maybe some of these big box store types will really become more of like, hey, you're still online shopping, but you've got local distribution. I don't know.
You know, one thing I refuse to do on this whole trend. One of my vices is a sausage egg McMuffin from McDonald's.
Oh, dude.
Right? Just
don't even.
OJ and a hash brown.
Those hash browns.
Next,
just unreal. You make me hungry.
You go through the drive-thru. Will you be using your McDonald's app today for your order? It's like, no, I want to just drive through, grab my sandwich and go. And I refuse to do it. The same thing with Starbucks. You got to, and I get they want to, they're going to give you points, but they're selling all of your information. You look at their user agreement, right? Just, it's annoying. So there's a mix of, I think consumers just like me, this old man, 31 years old, that won't conform to those things, but life's going to get more complicated and honestly a little bit more annoying. You go inside McDonald's, you can't even order at the counter anymore. You got to use the stinking kiosk.
Yeah.
And growing up, I wanted to be the old man that sat in the back every day at 6 a.m. with his buddies chewing the fat. You know, they won't even have that. You have to find somewhere else.
You're all going to get on like a Zoom call.
That's so sad. So sad.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know where it goes. I don't know how that relates to, I mean, I guess commercial real estate. We were talking about that. Yeah, that
was a rabbit hole.
Yeah. But I mean, real estate's always local. And locally, it'll be interesting to see if any of like our bigger chain stores or that kind of thing. We're getting a Home Depot, which I think is awesome. But yeah, I think we still have a lack of commercial real estate here, you know,
that's for sure.
So it's always localized and of course a lack of residential. I mean, it's like just the small town problems.
Yeah.
Right.
What are your thoughts on what inflation is going to do this year?
I don't know that I have much of an informed opinion on that. Other than, I don't know. It seems like it will continue to go up, but I don't know. It'll be interesting to see if the Fed starts lowering rates, if that will just push inflation up again, you know?
Yeah.
We were talking about this the other day, but war, the instability in, you know, with the Houthi rebels and all this kind of stuff and the supply chain stuff, you know, I think could continue to be an issue. Those kind of things might continue to drive prices up. A lot of that's going to depend on what the government does, right? Are they going to bail out sections of people? Are they going to inject a bunch of cash into the system? Well, then, of course, we'll see inflation go up.
Right? Yeah. I don't think there's any chance of less spending this year taking place.
Yeah.
But it is going to be interesting. We could always, and when I say we, the United States could always just change the way they measure inflation again.
What?
Right?
Tell me about that.
So since the 1980s, we've changed the way that we've measured inflation like 35 times. So it's you know, we think of measurement as a fixed standard, but we haven't really believed in that since miles per hour or inches. Our dollar is not a fixed measurement of value. And that's just inherent in how we live our life at this point.
Yeah.
So they'll just change the way they measure it. They'll make it look better. I could see this is my tinfoil hat prediction for 2024.
Okay, let's hear it.
Here we go. The Fed has their back up against the wall because banks are truly not in a healthy position. When they removed the reserve requirements that banks had to have during COVID, they never reinstated it. And they're trying to now come back and reinstate it. But banks already have major, major losses on paper from the mortgage bonds that they were holding that the Fed then deteriorated in value by hiking the rates. And they're
now, will that come back though as they lower rates?
The value?
Yeah.
Yes. Mortgage bond prices have already increased.
So is that part of why they're talking about lowering the rates to try to help these mortgage bond prices that all these banks are holding?
I think so. I think that is the underlying reason that we're even having conversations coming from the Fed. If you look back in November, a week before Jay Powell took the stage and said, basically, we're done and we're anticipating 3 rate decreases next year. The week prior to that, Fed members were very aggressive in saying, it's premature. We shouldn't be having this conversation. It's premature. And then he comes out and totally flips the script. Mortgage rates go down. It was a great thing. But the underlying reason for that is the instability in banking. So I think that's why they're going to change the measure of inflation again, to show, they'll basically try to show that they've beat inflation. Rah, rah, we're all there. But the banks are really going to have a tough time this year. And when the bank, BTFP, I think it's called the Bank Trade Funding Program, BTFP. Bank Term Funding Program. I always forget that. When that closes in March, it's going to be really interesting to see how it shakes out. So
I know you mentioned like regional banks are going to be hit really hard by that.
Yeah.
Right. Can you go see what banks have their reserves in? Like could you go and look and say, oh wow, you know, Main Street Bank is really heavily into mortgage-backed securities.
Or is it
mortgage
can.
Bonds, not mortgage-backed
securities. MBS, same. Yeah, it works the same way.
They're the same.
Yeah. Okay. I'm sure you can. I've never taken a good look at it. The ones I'm sure you could just go back to around the time that SVB failed.
Right.
Right. And just look at all the banks that went negative 15% in a single day. In their stock prices. Those are the ones, right? But it'd be really interesting to see because Fannie Mae came out yesterday and lowered, they came out with predictions for 2024 rates in December, came out yesterday with even lower forecasts. All while inflation is ticking back up, unemployment is super strong, consumer sentiment we just saw today, retail sales are up, PCE's next week. And that's the Fed's favorite measure of inflation. So they're kind of going to be in this double bind. We have an economy that is so kind of roaring back. You'd think that they'd be going on another rate hike spree, but they can't. So I think we are in for more inflation. I agree with you.
Yeah. So are they just going to have to keep playing this game of bouncing up and down, right? It's just trying to hit this delicate balance.
Yeah, the soft landing they're talking about. I was thinking about this last night. The soft landing they're talking about is only possible if they change the way they measure inflation and then print more money, which is then going to increase inflation.
Yeah.
And I think that's why the whole 1970s inflation issue has even become a talking point. But what did we expect was going to happen? Like, look how loose we've been with our dollars since 2020. And then to continue to have the current administration fighting back against the Fed by printing dollars, borrowing more money, deficit spending at all-time high. What do we think is going to happen?
Forgiving more student loan debt as of today, right? Another headline.
It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And we all lose from it. And honestly, this is why I started looking into Bitcoin. right? This is why you and I had that conversation.
Here's
this stuff.
I knew it would lead to Bitcoin. No. It's interesting because that's, I mean, inflation, right? It's that silent killer of people's returns, right? It's like, that's what people don't factor in. And same with home price appreciation, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah, my home went up. Let's say my home went up 3% this last year, mm-hmm. even though, you know, rates are high and all that kind of thing. Well, where's inflation at? 3%. So did it really go up?
Yeah.
Right? If your investment went up, let's say you invested money, it went up 10%, inflation's at 6%. Well, you really didn't. It's stealing, silently stealing all of that value,
silent
right?
Tax. Yep.
Yeah. So what about the fact that Bitcoin's been dropping the last?
Yeah.
Like today. So this is a weird one, right? Like this is, you haven't convinced me yet. Back and forth, but like gold was up this morning. Bitcoin's down, you know, stuff like that. It's just like, man, it's hard to make sense of all that.
So the way that I'm not a Bitcoin bro. I just want to notate that
for the record.
What I am is anti-fiat currency.
Yeah.
And as I've been reading about how the United States manages its currency, it's really disgusting because I take very much pride in how I work hard, try to be strategic, put your head down, do the things you need to do, avoid being foolish. And so inherently in me, there is this expectation of I will achieve something through the work that I do. And it robs the hardworking Americans or anybody holding the dollar from truly being able to maximize the value long-term. Like you get better at your job every single year. And yet the money that you're paid to do it is worth less. What does that say? Inherently and subconsciously, I think it tells us that we should take the easier route. We should spend the money. Bryce Gonzer, my business partner, who is like signed, sealed, delivered 100% Bitcoin, he would not eat and buy more Bitcoin. That's how sold he is on this. Really explained it well. If you decided next year or this year that you need to buy a new XYZ, something expensive, right? I need a new snowblower. And I don't really need a new snowblower, but I want a new snowblower. In our current system, you're incentivized to go buy that snowblower because if you hold on to those dollars, next year you're not buying the snowblower for the same price. You're going to have to buy it with more. So we're incentivized not to save. But if we lived in a world where we had a fixed...
Yeah, or you're incentivized to invest. It's like if those dollars, if I can hold off on buying that snowblower, mm-hmm. again... It, as we just said, it depends on inflation versus what returns you can get. But let's say I can invest that money and get 8% return and my money is going to be worth 4% less or that snowblower sure. is going to be 4% more next year because of inflation. Well, I'm still better off
because you invest
investing your dollars.
But don't you think that we should have the liberty to choose whether we want to invest or save? And saving is not a bad thing. So you might think twice before buying the snowblower that you want rather than the snowblower you need.
Yeah.
Right? It's just one of those things. I think it goes down to the moral fabric of who we are and the lens that we see life through. The way we exchange value has a lot of morality linked to it. It's very interesting.
Yeah.
If you think about it through that lens. So the reason I even brought up Bitcoin is because it's finite. It is defined 21 million. And enough people have said this is something that will hold value because it is finite.
You know what else they're not making any more of? Land.
I knew you were going to say that. That is true. That is true.
I see. You may not be a Bitcoin bro. I'm a real estate bro.
Yeah, you are.
Which can come back to bite you. I mean, I was telling you about this earlier, but I was listening to a podcast about Bitcoin and the physical deterioration, depreciation, as well as taxes are mm-hmm. one of the things that eat into your real estate, right? Sure. So they might not be making any more of it, but they'll tax you on it every year.
Oh, yeah.
So.
And you never really own it.
Yeah, you're renting it from the government.
You're renting it from the government. which we could go on a whole spree on that. But all in all, it seems like we're poised for change. Would you agree? Something's got to change.
Yeah. So what would you do this year? You're in the position of, does your advice as a mortgage broker change given everything we've just talked about for this year?
I would just say always, always, always lean on your budget, right? Have a plan, lean on your budget for those that can afford a higher payment right now. Still, it's still a great time to buy, right? For those that have the excess income, there's no problem with real estate. In fact, I think real estate, it should be more integrated into people's portfolios than it is on a national level. So, but what I would say is make sure that your debt's in order. Make sure your house is in order, right? How's the job looking? Is there any chance that you could be potentially laid off? If that's the case, maybe think twice, right? If you're working in tech, for example, I think this year is going to be maybe a harder year for tech. Last year, obviously the returns were great, but yeah, just lean on your budget. Make wise decisions based upon that. Don't get into the frenzy. I posted something on Instagram earlier this week. It's like, just work at your pace. Take one step closer to your goal. If you're a first-time buyer or you're a first-time investor, just do something today that gets you a little bit closer to your goal.
So let's take that first-time home buyer, and I know we probably got to get going too, but take that first-time home buyer as an example. Yep. What are some of those small steps that they can take? You're talking about saving more? You're talking about paying off debt? I know it's very individualized, right? Sure. It totally depends on their situation, but are there a couple things that you would say, hey, take these steps, start saving a little bit more every month? Or
I think first is get oriented where you are financially, right? Do a total financial review. There is an app that I absolutely love. If you're anything like me and you really despise manual budgeting, there is an app that I run called Copilot. It basically aggregates all of your accounts. You have one dashboard and it tracks. So it's a really fantastic tool to just get an idea of how much you're spending, how much you're saving, where's your expenses at. Next is make sure you have some reserves. So if you don't already have a savings account, the Dave Ramsey adage of like get to $1,000 and then start paying off your debt in a snowball, that needs to be increased to $5,000.
So is that kind of your threshold, or is there like a percentage or a number of months of expenditures that you suggest for
the average
for reserves?
Yeah. If you're self-employed or you're commission only, I think 6 months is a minimum. You should be able to float your life for 6 months and not have major lifestyle changes. If you're a W-2 employee and your job's solid, 3 months is great. But if you have no savings and you said, what is my first step? Well, make sure you have $5,000 set aside. That is your never touch it. It's going to deflate. It's going to lose value with inflation, all of that, right?
Yeah.
You're just like, this is my survival money. And then from there, start to aggressively save. Invest your money in things that will grow with it. Treasuries have been awesome. 5% returns on treasuries. Fantastic. And it's the government would have to fail not to pay you back. So very, very safe. By the way, not a financial advice. I'm not a licensed financial advisor. Consult your accountant. But yeah, I would say those two things. Those are the first two steps I would take if I was a first-time buyer, is orient yourself, where am I at financially, and then get some reserves saved up, without a doubt.
And call Fulcrum.
Yeah, right. Little plug there.
No, I mean, I'm joking a little bit because you're here, but also being serious, like you should have those conversations with a lender early.
Yeah.
If you're like, hey, I think I might want to buy my first house in 2024, you should already be talking to a lender, right? Because that's what I always tell people is it's like, I can get, I know enough to be dangerous about it, right? But it is so specific that your particular lender might say, hey, in your situation, I think your savings are in a good place. Let's start paying off this debt, or let's do this or that, or not. Don't worry about that debt. Let's focus on this, like create a plan to get there, right? And you got this, it's such a, to me, a mystery world. Like the land is like, underwriting and everything else, you're like, you need to talk to somebody who really knows that world to tell you exactly what you should do to get where you need to go.
Yeah. I think there's a lot more demand than we even realize, because there are enough people that have opted themselves out or disqualified themselves and said, payment's going to be too high. I'm not going to be able to afford it.
Right.
When actually they could. So that would, I guess, be another piece of advice is start the conversation and assemble your team a lot earlier than you think you need to.
Yeah.
Assemble your team. And real estate agents are an integral part. They are the captain of the transaction. They're the ones that are going to make sure that the lender does their job right, the title, insurance, everything goes the way it should, right? But when demand spikes again, if you're, we saw this over and over in COVID. If you're not starting the conversation early, you will be rushed and rushed
if you're financial decisions. If you're not prepared.
Exactly right. So,
well, you're going to be rushed or you're going to miss out.
Or you'll miss out.
Right. Same as an investor. Same first-time home buyer, same with an investor. You know, it's like those good deals, we are in such a sparse inventory environment. Those good deals don't necessarily come around that often. Completely. When they do, you better be ready.
That's right.
Right? You better be ready to go.
Especially up here.
And as investors, like you were talking about this year, I think it is all that more important to be conservative mm-hmm. with your projections out of your rental real estate investment property, however you want to talk about it. Because if there's a number of things that could increase vacancies mm-hmm. or decrease bookings at your Airbnb or whatever, that you want to make sure that you're not working with too skinny of a margin.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Man, good as always, Mike.
Yeah. Yeah, it was fun. Good conversation. And look forward to having you on again. Good luck with Fulcrum. How things are going well.
Man,
it's been a lot. People can still find you in the same place.
Same spot, downtown Moscow.
On 3rd Street.
3rd Street.
Main Street? 3rd Street. 3rd Street. Yeah. Kind of both.
Yeah. It's a little walk down the sidewalk here, but going to tear it up this year.
Thanks, Brandon.
See you, bro.
Thanks for joining us. Like, share, subscribe. We'll see you next week.